Listen and stream the only talk radio, Freedom 106.5, for the only talk that matter.
Welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. As customary, we have our Thursday morning program, Doctors on Call, and joining us as usual, we have Dr. Nadira Rambukas. Of course, she is a well-experienced in the medical field for a number of years. No stranger to us. Good morning, Dr. Rambukas. How are you today?
Good, Govin. Good to have you back today. Good morning, listeners, and good morning, Professor, our special guest today.
Yes, we do have a special guest, and that's Professor Hariharan Sitaraman, and he's going to be telling us all about intensive care. So before we get into it with Professor Dr. Rambukas, what was the genesis or the reasoning behind today's topic, firstly?
So, Professor, I just want to introduce him a little bit. He's quite accomplished in his field in anesthesia and critical care medicine. He's the Director of Graduate Studies and Research at the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine. He's a consultant anesthetist intensivist at the Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex. He has formerly held positions as a Deputy Dean of Clinical Sciences, Deputy Dean of Graduate Studies and Research of the Faculty of Medical Sciences, Director of the Operating Theater Services, and Head of the Department of Anesthesia and Intensive Care, Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex. In addition to his medical degrees, he also has a PhD in health economics. He has published over 135 peer-reviewed papers and authored chapters in textbooks. He was awarded several different awards, including an honorary fellowship in critical care by the American College of Critical Care Medicine for his outstanding contribution to the field of critical care medicine. He was also awarded the Vice Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Research and the School of Honor from the TTMA. He is the immediate past president of Bioethics Society of the English-speaking Caribbean and the immediate past president of the Anesthesis Association. He held two terms as the secretary of the Medical Council, and he's the current editor-in-chief of the Caribbean Medical Journal and a chairperson of NCRG Ethics Committee. So quite an extensive curriculum vitae and career. So welcome, Professor.
Thank you so much, Nadira, and thanks for the opportunity with Freedom 106.5 to talk about intensive care, which is not the usual topics because, Nadira, when people ask me what is your specialty, I will say you don't want to come to me. Because it's critical care. I don't want people to get critically ill, but we need to talk about critical care units and intensive care to just increase the awareness in the general public of what we do in intensive care.
So could you tell me how long you've been practicing medicine and what was your motivation for choosing anesthetics and critical care, intensive care?
As a young doctor from after finishing my MBBS, I went back to my hometown and I started working in the internal medicine, general medicine department. But as a young doctor in the general hospital, we have to do all duties, general duties, I mean, casualty duty. Even postmortem, I have conducted everything. So I was planning to, you know, join internal medicine as my first choice, but what happened is that, you know, I got interested in critical care right when I was in internal medicine. Those days we had only a coronary care unit. People with heart attacks and other issues. I mean, where those days we did not even have all these paraphernalia of ventilator and all that stuff. So we used some pharmacological methods and with oxygen and so on and so forth. We saved many patients, and I got so much involved with the intensive care unit in that small general hospital. And I attended a Indo-US symposium, which was in India. The US intensivists came and conducted a symposium in India. It's just very, very long back. In the 90s, I don't know if you were born that time. So I attended that, and I got so much interested in intensive care. And then when in India, it's very, very, very highly competitive to get into a medical postgrad degree. You know, even in Trinidad, it has become like that now. So I wrote entrance exams, and then, you know, I wrote an exam in one particular university, there anesthesiology was integral part of the critical care medicine. So then I took anesthesiology as my career to learn intensive care medicine. Initially, there were lots of, you know, even my mom told, you're going to become a chloroform doctor. that's how they call the anesthesiologist. So from 87, I have been in the field of medicine. But if you take my medical school days from 1982, I am in medicine. So it's a very, very long way. And from the early 90s, I am with anesthesiology and intensive care. So intensive care has been my, anchor, specialty, where I've done a lot of research. And even now, on a regular basis, I take on calls, night on calls in Eric Williams. Every week I take on calls because I am so passionate about intensive care. Although, as we go along, I will tell you that, you know, there are lots of disenchantment over the years, which is a systemic issue, which we cannot get away from that, and we can talk about it in the course of the interview.
So, could you explain to us what exactly is anesthesia and why is it important in medicine? And then, how do patients move from, say, a normal admission to intensive or critical care?
Sure. You know, in the 1800s, there was no anesthesia. There were four muscle men holding the patient when people used to do surgery. And in Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, I visited there. You know, they call it an ether dome there. On the fourth floor, those days in the 1800s, they did not even have an elevator to go across there. But the surgical theater, operating theater, was in the fourth floor. You know why? Because they used sunlight through the dome for the light for the operations they had to conduct. Because there was no electricity, there was no operating lights. That was one reason. The second reason is that the patient used to scream while doing surgery, and they didn't want the other patients to listen to the screaming, because, you know, the other patients will refuse surgery. So that is why they took the operating theater to the fourth floor. So that was the history of anesthesia. And then, you know, this dental student who was playing with ether, diethyl ether, came to know that it has some tendencies of anesthetizing. And he demonstrated these diethyl ethers' anesthetic potential in that same place where I told you, in Massachusetts General Hospital. And then the whole history changed. And we started using diethyl ether for a long time. Almost a century we used diethyl ether as the anesthetic. It was a very safe anesthetic. But what happens is that it is a highly soluble anesthetic. So the people take lots of time to come out. So anesthesia is one of the very, very modern specialties. And I will tell you that in the 1800s or early 1900s, when anesthesia was in vogue, I mean, there used to be a lot of surgical mortality, because we never had these many antibiotics. Surgery was not safe. Anesthesia was not safe at that time. People used to vomit, regurgitate, aspirate into their lungs and all that stuff. But currently, if you see how we have evolved and the amount of drugs and the paraphernalia we have in anesthesiology, anesthesia has become extremely safe, very, very, very safe. Even for, pregnant women, even until the 1960s and 70s, anesthesia was a real horror. And now it has become extremely safe. And less than, like, if you see the mortality associated with anesthesia, it's very, 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 very minimal, minuscule. You know, 1 in 100,000 or somewhere around that. You know, that much safe anesthesia has become. And that is how surgery has progressed. Only because anesthesiology came into existence, they could invent new procedures, new surgeries, long surgeries. You know, where in my residency days, I have sat in the theater for 48 hours, 72 hours to do microvascular surgery. They will just re-implant an amputated leg in the accident with all the tendons and the blood vessels. They will stitch together, and it takes 48 hours. So we have to sit there and be with the patient. So because anesthesia has become very safe, you know, even after that 48 hours, the patients wake up very sound and healthy. There's no problem with their conscious level and so on and so forth. So that is how anesthesia has become. And, you know, the older patients used to ask me, "Doc, how long before I will wake up after surgery?" I will say, "You will wake up immediately on the operating theater and on the operating table." And they will be surprised that that is how we have moved. So because anesthesia involves an acutely, critically, you know, we take the patient into deep sleep. We completely paralyze them, take over their physiological functions like the respiration. Their breathing is under our control. Their heartbeat is under our control. Their blood pressure is our control. So that is how anesthesiologists became the pioneers in intensive care. So if you see the intensive care is a specialty where a patient becomes extremely critically ill and their organs are starting to fail. So we admit them into intensive care to provide organ support, right? And to allow the body to heal that organ, and we take over the organ support. If the lungs fail, we put them on a mechanical ventilator. For heart, we put them some pharmacological or even, you know, balloon pump and so on and so forth. And for kidneys, if they fail, we give them renal replacement therapy, you know, hemodialysis and so on. So organ support is the major key thing which we do in an intensive care unit. So because anesthesiologists are involved with the physiological functions of organs, and we are very thorough with how to support the organs, and that is how we became pioneers in intensive care. And currently intensive care is being taken by many, many specialties, including, you know, surgical residents, you know, pulmonary critical care, internal medicine, pediatric medicine, so on and so forth. But still, anesthesiologists in the British Commonwealth, anesthesiologists are the ones who are pioneers and who take care of intensive care units in the hospitals.
Thank you. Is there a difference in, say, anesthesia for an emergency procedure versus an elective procedure?
Yes, there is a lot of difference. And that is why I tell my students to be present, even the medical students, MBBS students, to be present during an emergency operating theater, because the physiology and the way the patient present is completely different from an elective surgery. An elective surgery, we optimize, we do have the time. For example, I'll tell you a simple, very simple thing that, you know, like if the patient is anemic, the patient's hemoglobin level is so low, we have the time for elective surgery to bring back the hemoglobin to a normal, optimal level. We give them all possible medications, if needed, transfusion, so on and so forth, and then bring them with an optimal hemoglobin for elective surgery. But if a patient with a gunshot wound or a stab wound or a motor vehicle accident who has lost liters and liters of blood, they come into operating theater and we have to go in and stop the bleeding to save their life, their physiology is completely different. So we have to be very careful in how we use our medications. What are all the problems with the organ when their physiological derangement is so much? So we accordingly, use the medications which are safe enough and which will not adversely impact on the morbidity and mortality of this patient. So emergency surgery is a completely different ball game, and that is why, you know, we train our anesthesiology residents very, very specifically for emergency surgery. And if we bring about an outcome which is a desirable outcome without much of a morbidity and mortality in an emergency surgical patient, that speaks to the quality of care in anesthesiology.
Okay, thank you, Professor. We have to take a brief commercial break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about anesthesia and intensive care.
Sure, thank you.
That's right. This is Doctors on Call on Freedom 106.5 FM.
Is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
And we're back at 9:18 in Trinidad and Tobago. Welcome back to our special segment, Doctors on Call, with Dr. Nadira Rambokas. And we've got intensivist Professor Hariharan Sitaraman with us this morning. So as we continue along, Professor, I understand that, you know, the ICU, once we hear about the ICU and intensive care, it can be something that is very scary, can create a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear as well. For our listeners, can you explain perhaps some of the monitoring systems and maybe the medication that is used to alleviate the fears that family members and so on may have?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, my favorite, in my presentation, I show them an image of the NASA and the equipment in NASA. When you go inside without knowing what it is, you will get flabbergasted. And that is exactly a common layperson will feel when they come into an intensive care unit. So many bleeps all over in the place and, you know, alarms, and then the nurses running here and there, and it'll be like a real terror. I can understand that. But as I told you, the patients come in with organ failure. Now, when a patient's organ have failed, there'll be lots and lots of physiological issues we will face. Like, for example, if a patient, I will give you a very simple example, a diabetic patient who had a foot infection, and it became a bit of a gangrenous, and now they come into emergency department with a sepsis, what we call as a sepsis, which are infection spread to all the organs. Now, what happens is that, you know, when there is sepsis, the blood pressure goes down, so the heart fails. Now, the lungs, the oxygenation capacity goes down, so the lung fails. And because the blood pressure goes down, the kidney is not getting enough blood supply, so the kidney is also starting to fail. And then, you know, then they have to be now supported at least in three organs. Some old people, what will happen is that because, again, the blood supply is very poor throughout the organ systems, they also become unconscious. So the brain is also starting to fail. So there are four organs failing. Now, what we have to do, we have to take them to the intensive care unit and see that how their organs are currently, you know, functioning. So that is why we need the monitors. As anesthesiologists, I mean, as a postgraduate teacher, we teach the physics of monitor to our students, because we need to be very thorough with how these monitors function, and you know, what happens when there is an alarm, you know, whether we can, you know, ignore the alarm, and how to go and attend to the alarm and attend to the patient, and so on and so forth. So mechanical ventilatory support, it has lots and lots of physics. It has lots of monitors. And there is a patient monitor which will tell us the beat-to-beat blood pressure, the beat-to-beat oxygenation of the patient, and then we will also see the respiratory pattern, how much is the carbon dioxide, how much is the oxygen in the body, how much oxygen we have to give to this patient, and whether the urine output is adequate or not, and if the urine output goes down, whether we have to attach them to what we call as a CRRT. I don't want to go into the details of it, but it's a renal replacement therapy, which is called a continuous, you know, kidney support. So what we do is that, you know, we have lots and lots of catheters from the patient. It goes into the neck to measure their, you know, the blood volume, and it goes into their hand. The catheter goes into their blood vessel to see the beat-to-beat blood pressure. And then a catheter goes into the other side of the neck, which will actually go into this renal support machine. Slowly the blood will be taken from the blood, and all the toxic waste will be filtered by this equipment, and then the blood will be sent back to the patient to provide this kidney support. And there are many, many medications which will actually, we will have to, you know, regulate the blood pressure If the blood pressure is low, we have to bring them up. If it is too high, we have to bring them down. And then the heart rate the same way. If it is too low, we have to bring it to the optimal level. If it is too high, we have to bring it back. And then, you know, when the physiological derangement goes too bad, sometimes they develop cardiac arrest. I mean, when we are watching, the heart will stop and then we have to restart it back. You know, they can have the rhythm disturbances. So we will have this, you would have seen that in most of the medical programs in Chicago Hope and all that, when the people will come with a shock and patient will just jump and you know, I mean, it's a bit exaggerated. We will go to those aspects of it later, the ethical aspects of intensive care. But these are the type of monitoring equipment and many equipment which will be in the intensive care unit. But I must say that, you know, for a non-medical person, it may be looking really too much. But for us, we are used to it, and we have saved patients after attaching so many machines and providing organ support. They have come out of the intensive care unit and walked home, and that is the better part of the intensive care unit.
Right. Because you mentioned in terms of a great deal of it has to do with multi-organ failure or multi-system failure. Is there a particular tipping point before this sort of domino effect kind of kicks in? Is there a particular tipping point or a particular area before that a patient may have to be taken into ICU or intensive care? Any point that you could identify then?
Correct. I mean, this is a very, 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 very important question. And I told you, as a health economist, I've been trying to preach and increase awareness about this, our silent killers, which are the diabetes, hypertension type of chronic diseases. You know, I will give you a standing example, I mean, which is very, very, very common. Every week I have seen one. They come to the emergency department, all right, with severe shortness of breath. When we put on these monitors, the oxygen will be too low. And when we put on the stent and listen to their chest, it'll be all over crackles and we can't even hear breath sounds. And their heart rate will be touching the roof. And we ask the patient, most of the times they may not be even able to answer. And when we ask the next to the kin, they will say, oh no, he was absolutely fine. There is absolutely no problem. He never had any issue. He never went to a doctor. But when we do a test, we will know that blood sugar is again touching the roof. Urea creatinine is again touching the roof. The patient would have had high blood pressure for the past 5 or 6 years. He never would have visited the doctor. And the problem with the high blood pressure and the uncontrolled blood sugar is that they target the end organs. They target the kidneys. They target the heart. And what happens when the target organ is involved is that they fail. And with a kidney failure and with the retention of fluid in the body system, which will retain in the lung also, they are unable to breathe now. And that is how they land up in the emergency department. So if they would have checked their blood pressure, anybody above 40 must have a visit and then say that, you know, like, I mean, their blood sugars are okay. Their blood pressure is okay. And, you know, it's just that it's a routine checkup there is nothing wrong because, you know, we have a very high prevalence of diabetes and hypertension in our population. And there is nothing wrong in visiting a doctor once and just get some counseling and advice. Not necessarily that every doctor's visit will put you into medications and you have to start medications and all that. It is almost like to maintain your health. You can just do a routine checks and then see that your blood sugars are normal, your blood pressure is normal. To avoid this tipping point which you are talking about, that is the tipping point. When they ignore all these diseases and then lead on to an organ failure, and that precipitates an acute physiological derangement which requires an intensive care unit. And this can be avoided at the primary care level, at the general practitioner level, if everybody is compliant with this protocol of having a regular checkup. And if they happen to have some sort of a chronic diseases, they can just treat them and keep them under control at the primary care level, which will definitely reduce the intensive care admissions. And many countries are there. For as an example, I will say right here in the Caribbean, PAHO has admired Cuba to have this type of a very strong primary healthcare system. District health visitors, they go door to door, they check the people right there, and then chronic diseases are very well controlled. And if a doctor and a nurse visit the patient, they get much more compliant in taking medications. They don't put leave the medications in the cabinet. So to answer to this doctor and the nurse. So these are very good primary care level things which we can adopt in a population of 1.3 million. And primary care should be given lots of importance, so that we can avoid this tipping point you are seeing and intensive care unit admissions.
Thanks so much, Professor.
Is a lot of our admissions to ICU based on chronic disease and its complications?
I must say yes at this point of time, because we are reasonably okay with respect to infectious diseases. I know that during the pandemic it was COVID, and we do get sporadic cases of the influenza, the different strains of it. We do get that. Rarely we do get some in south intensive care. We get you would have known that leptospirosis is common in south with the flooding and the with the rodents and so on and so forth. But majority of the infectious diseases we have tried to control. We don't have much of a issue like in the past. But the infectious disease, what we get is from the diabetes, diabetic foot, gangrene, and the sepsis syndrome with the diabetes, and the chronic diseases complicating the infectious disease, and complicated by way of infectious diseases and multi-organ failure. So I think infectious diseases we still have good but the thing is that once infection spreads to the organ system, it cannot be treated by antibiotics alone. That is the point I wanted to say. People should not think that, infection spread to the organs, so what, we can give antibiotic. No, it is a completely different type of pathology. Okay, a focalized infection can lead on to an organ failure, and the organ failure is a completely different ball game. And that is why we have to connect them to all these machines in intensive care unit to bring them back. And then, the problem is that, to answer your question specifically, we know that, there are patients who are frequent visitors to the ICU because they don't get control, they don't get their primary care physician to control their chronic diseases. And they come out of ICU alive and well, go back home, and then do the same thing, and then land up at unit. So that is the ignorance we have to fight against, and that is the awareness we have to raise in all our people. There are diseases which can be definitely dealt with at primary and secondary care level. We don't need to get to the tipping point of organ failure, which will require an intensive care support.
You're listening to the very special program, Doctors on Call. We've got to take a break at this point in time. But before that, reminding you, our listeners, of our contact numbers. If you want to call later on, we'll have a segment where you can send us your messages, your questions, and so on for Professor Rambukasan and Dr. Rambukasan and Professor. Of course, our WhatsApp number 306-1065 and our studio number 627-3223, 625-2257.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
So welcome back, Doctors on Call. We've got, of course, Dr. Rambukas with us and Professor Sita Ramand with us. So Dr. Rambukas, just reminding our listeners again of our contact numbers, 627-3223, 625-2257, and on WhatsApp, 306-1065. Dr. Rambukas?
I wanted to ask about anesthesia. Is there a difference between general and local anesthesia? And what tests do patients have to go through before each?
Okay. The anesthesia, we always prepare what we call as a regional anesthesia and the general anesthesia, the two distinct ones. Local anesthetic, usually the surgeons themselves will give it. Even in dental offices, you would have known that they just, and in your own specialty for cosmetic reasons, you can inject local anesthetic. But when it is a regional anesthesia and a general anesthesia, an anesthesiologist should be involved. Okay, and we prepare the patient with the understanding that, you know, a regional anesthetic technique can fail because it's a blind technique. Although currently we have lots of ultrasounds and many other equipment to improve the success rate of regional techniques. What we give is spinal and epidural anesthesia, which is in the backbone. Those are still blind techniques, and sometimes we may not be able to get those type of techniques in, and so we prepare them as if they have to come for a general anesthesia. The basic thing is that currently, you know, they should not have any solid food for 8 hours at least, which will be different in kids and stuff like that, but for adults like that. And I must tell you that again, as a health economist, only this January we published one of my students' research from one of the hospital where we found out that there is so much of unnecessary testing before anesthesia and surgery. You know, there are specific guidelines, international guidelines, based on the patient physiology and the type of surgery they have to undergo, the type of anesthesia they have to undergo. There are specific tests which are mandatory, and there are tests which are unnecessary. But in the current setting of litigation and many other issues which we face, we overdo these tests, and that is going to be really biting for a patient when they are in the private sector. They have to pay for every single test. Even in the public sector, they don't pay it out of the pocket, but the government has to pay the expenditure. So that the research which we did is in a public hospital, but still the government had to bear the cost of all these unnecessary tests. So investigations is before anesthesia and surgery is a big topic on its own, and it has economic impact. It has a lot of other legal impact and so on and so forth. But there are very, very, very clear guidelines throughout the world. And we do follow what we call as the NICE guidelines, which is the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, Healthcare Excellence. That is from the United Kingdom. And they have very, because they also have the public healthcare system, they have very good guidelines which can be tailored to our public healthcare system. And that is what we try to follow to test these patients.
Are there any complications with general, regional, and local anesthesia, and are they common?
Yeah, as I told you, those days there are when anesthesia was in the neonatal or infancy stage, they had lots and lots of issues pertaining to anesthesia. But now we have we have improved quite a bit. The current gas. The anesthesiologists are called gas men, so we administer the gas. So the current volatile agent, the gas which we administer to make the patient sleep, is a very, very, very modern one. They go into sleep very fast and they come out very fast. The lungs, take them up very, very fast, and the lung excrete them very, very fast. So they are very poorly soluble in the blood. So we have come out a long way. So the complications pertaining to anesthesia has become very low. But still, we can have anaphylaxis. That means drug allergies, because anesthesia is one branch where we use lots and lots of medications. Same in intensive care. We do lots and lots of pharmacological management. And we don't know which patient will be allergic to which drug. So that is one possible complication which can have. Even with the local anesthetic allergies are there. And when we give the spinal or the epidural anesthesia, sometimes, the blood pressure can go down very low. And, in my practice, I have seen many, many patients like that. Not my own patient, but, in my practice, I have seen, how patients would have had low blood pressure and it would be difficult for us to bring back the blood pressure. These are some of the complications, but all these are very minuscule nowadays in 2023. And that is why, you know, surgeons are comfortable in deciding a surgery, you know, cesarean section and so on and so forth. Those days, cesarean section, they will be rarely scheduling a cesarean emergency section. They will try the lady to be in labor for 72 hours, you know, 4 days and so on and so forth, because they were afraid of surgery. But now, you know, they are able to decide early and give a good quality of, you know, outcome for both the baby and the mother, because anesthesia is very, very safe.
Thank you. Presently, switching gears a little bit, what is our ICU occupancy of persons suffering COVID-19?
Okay, so that it fluctuates a bit, but currently as for COVID-19 alone, it is not it's not too much. It has seen some decline now. Kuwa ICU is the COVID ICU, as you know, and there were other in the other RHAs also. They had dedicated hospitals and dedicated ICUs, which have seen a declining trend with respect to COVID alone, because the current variants, the percentage of patients who require intensive care is not as the original variant. The Delta variant was the worst. And, in COVID, 85% of the people would have corrected themselves on their own. 15% are the ones who require some sort of a hospitalization. And among that 15, only 5% require the intensive care support. Okay. And in that 5%, those days when the Delta variant was there, half of them used to die. So the mortality, the overall mortality from COVID was around 2.5%. But current, the Omicron has, the mortality has gone down to 1% or even less. So it's almost very similar to influenza. So the ICU occupancy from COVID has been declining. But I must say that the ICU occupancy in general in the country, in all the public healthcare system, is always above 80 to 90%. The statistics mean that we are always in demand of an ICU bed. That is what it means. The normal occupancy rate, annual occupancy rate, should be around 50 to 60%. That is the normal occupancy in most other countries, right? But here, it is always 80 to 90% occupancy rate. We did a lot of study on the cost of ICU and so on and so forth, and I can be very sure that our occupancy rates are very, very high because we do not have, enough ICU beds, which is a problem for a long period of time. And we have to improve. We do have all the paraphernalia, the equipment, you name anything, we do have it in the public. There's absolutely no, deficiency in the resources which we need. But the human resources are one major issue, especially, nursing care, because of critical care nurses, we are still in the decline. I know that Ministry of Health is now working with us, with the University of West Indies, to train a lot of nurses in critical care. But we lose a lot of critical care nurses to the other countries. That's the biggest problem. I have seen that from the time I have come here. You know, I've been more than 2 decades in this country. And, we train the critical care nurses and then they'll be absorbed by the developed world, and we lose them always to the North American countries and the United Kingdom and Europe. And so that is the perennial problem we have, and that is why we are unable to increase our ICU bed strength. And I will say that in that particular again, I want to increase the awareness that for a small population, if we take care of ourselves at the primary care level, we can manage to, do with the minimal number of intensive care beds. There is no doubt about it. And, when we don't take care of ourselves, that is when we have to convert some 3 or 4 beds in the emergency department as an ICU, because we don't have an ICU bed. So we have to convert these beds into ICU, and they may not get the appropriate care which is desirable in the setting outside of ICU. But that is how we manage at this point of time, because of you know, increased number of patients who require ICU. And I must say that, you know, that is why we are unable to schedule elective surgeries which require intensive care, post-operative intensive care admission. Because when we are always occupied with, you know, critically ill patients who land up in emergency department, how we can now subject somebody to a surgery and, you know, we will, and then bring them, we cannot bring them to an ICU, and how we can do that. So many of these patients are waiting because of that, you know, ICU occupancy rate. So it's a big subject, but what we can do from us as people, we need to take care of ourselves. We need to be compliant with our diabetic medications, with the blood pressure medications, take care of our kidneys, take care of our physical exercise, you know, take care of our lipids, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, if we can avoid these chronic diseases and organ failure, we can definitely address this ICU occupancy problem.
Thank you, Professor. We have to take a short commercial break. When we'll be back, we'll talk about health economics.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
And we're back, Freedom 106.5 FM, just about 8.5 minutes before 10 o'clock. And before we continue along, Dr. Ambukasan, Professor, there's a question that's coming in to us on WhatsApp. So hopefully we could get a response on this before we continue along with the discussion. There's a phenomenon where patients may be under anesthesia, helpless, but they may be feeling all the pain that is associated with the proceeding, with the procedure. Can you explain what happens there?
Very, very interesting question. We teach our students about what we call as awareness during anesthesia. You know, as I told you, anesthesia, we give plenty of drugs, you know, what we call as a balanced anesthesia. One, to keep the patient asleep. One, to keep the, take away the pain from the patient. And one, to paralyze the patient, you know, so that we can take the control over the patient. And then the other things to, you know, like manage the other organ systems. But these are the three major things: the paralysis, the patient, to make the patient to sleep, and take away the pain from the patient. So we teach our anesthesiology residents that how you have to balance these three. Okay, despite all our efforts, every patient, every human being reacts differently to the drugs. So if there is an imbalance during the conduct of anesthesia, for example, we give the gas from the anesthetic machine, and if that gas actually not only makes the patient sleep, but also it can cause some problem, like, you know, decreasing the blood pressure. So when we see a decrease in the blood pressure, we will reduce the dose of that particular gas. So now what happens is, some patients, if we do not give enough gas to keep their brain, you know, completely sedated at an unconscious level, okay, and if they're not having enough, you know, analgesia medication, you know, and or the intensity of the surgical pain is very, very high, you know, sometimes what has happened is that we call it awareness during anesthesia. So the patient may be under anesthesia, but they may have a very vague sensation of what is happening around. And pain is very, very, very rare. I will tell you that it is 1 in a million or something like that. Patients may experience pain, but you know, the awareness during anesthesia, like listening to what people talk and so on. And I will give you a very interesting story that, you know, a patient sued a surgeon for calling something during surgery, which she remembered under anesthesia. So this happened in US. So this is very rare, but I'm just saying that, you know, that anesthesia, it doesn't guarantee that the patient will be completely knocked off, because we have to adjust our dosage of drugs according to the physiological derangements. But 95% to 98% of the time, when we give anesthesia, we try to be very balanced. And I can tell you that in a very, very minuscule patient, awareness has been reported in the literature. But we are now actually improving our anesthetic drugs to even prevent those type of awareness during anesthesia.
Thank you, Professor. You also have a PhD in health economics. Can you explain how useful that is in medicine?
Yeah, it's extremely important. I do feel that, you know, all doctors should have some sort of a training in the health economic aspect of it during their community medicine rotation or whatever, because, you know, healthcare has become, unfortunately, has become an industry, especially our big neighbor, U.S., it is a commercially oriented industry. Healthcare is an industry, and they see the annual growth in the healthcare sector. That is why there is a lot of pharmacological and industry push to, you know, to actually introduce a drug, introduce an equipment. And so, you know, I got so passionate about intensive care costs of intensive care, and that is how I thought that I should do a PhD in health economics, and that is what I did with comparing primary care, intensive care costs, and the benefits we receive from out of it. See, the thing is that, you know, with minimal costs, okay, we get the maximum benefits, and that is exactly what we call as a cost effectiveness in healthcare, and that is what we have to aim at. You know, the patients should spend minimal, because the funding of healthcare differs in different countries. You know, here we have a strong public healthcare system with almost 4 to 5% of our GDP allocated towards the healthcare system. But still, you know, we have some, ups and downs, inefficiencies, which we are dealing with on a daily basis. But we do have a strong public healthcare system. But in many countries, in my own home country, you know, it's 1 to 1.5% of the GDP is spent on public health care. So they have to rely on private health care, and there is a lot of out-of-pocket spending for the patients. And there is enough evidence that in those countries, in the African continent and in India and subcontinent, people have been pushed to poverty and below poverty line because of healthcare reasons, because they have to spend for their own healthcare. And that is what is the gist of health economics, how, you know, healthcare is funded in each country, and how we can actually ethically fund healthcare for the citizens of a country. And that is the focus and goal of any society, that, you know, healthcare should be a human right, and how we can actually fund to improve the healthcare access, which is not even present in the United States, because the closest thing which they came was the Affordable Health Care Act, and even that is not fully implemented as desired. And so, you know, universal health access is not possible even in the United States of America. So healthcare access is a human right, and how we can improvise this particular funding of healthcare for improving the access for a common citizen in a country. And that is the gist of health economics. And that is why all of us doctors should have some sort of a, awareness and knowledge about health economics. And it is ethically related also, because many of our practice, I tell you that, you know, ethics is also a very, very, very important dimension in our medical profession, professionalism and ethics, bedside manners, how to deal with, because nowadays with the improvement of technology, apps can diagnose better than us doctors. But why we are here, doctors? The doctors are here because of the ethical rapport with which we establish with the patient, and they trust us, and that is what is important as a medical profession at this point of time in 2023, when ChatGPT can do better than a doctor.
Thank you, Professor. Is there an email address if any of our listeners or patients want to contact you that they can reach you at?
Yes, it's very, very easy. UWI Hari, HARI, at yahoo.com.
Great. We want to thank our listeners. I want to thank you, Professor, for being informative and educational. And thanks to my co-host, Govind. So I want to wish everybody have a good day.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Rambokas, and thanks for the Freedom 106.5 for allowing me to express here, which is very rare, actually. And so, all other doctors will come, but intensivists very rarely come in. So thanks very much for the opportunity.
You're most welcome. Thank you again. So that, of course, wraps up Doctors on Call today. Thank you so much, Dr. Ram Bokas, joining us every Thursday at 9 a.m. right here on Freedom 106.5 FM. And, of course, special guest today, we had, of course, Professor Hariharan Sitaraman joining us on the program as well. So this is Freedom 106.5 FM. It is 10 o'clock in TNT.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.